An Essay on the Development of Christian Doctrine by John Henry Newman. Chapter 2, Part 4. Again, it is sometimes argued that such a dispensation would destroy our probation, as dissipating doubt, precluding the exercise of faith, and obliging us to obey, whether we wish it or no. And it is urged that a divine voice spoke in the first age, and difficulty and darkness rest upon all subsequent ones, as if infallibility and personal judgment were incompatible. But this is to confuse the subject. We must distinguish between a revelation and a reception of it, not between its earlier and later stages. A revelation in itself divine and guaranteed as such may from first to last be received, doubted, argued against, perverted, rejected by individuals according to the state of mind of each. Ignorance, misapprehension, unbelief, and other causes do not at once cease to operate because the revelation is in itself true and in its proofs irrefragable. We have, then, no warrant at all for saying that an accredited revelation will exclude the existence of doubts and difficulties on the part of those whom it addresses, or dispense with anxious diligence on their part, though it may, in its own nature, tend to do so. Infallibility does not interfere with moral probation. The two notions are absolutely distinct. It is no objection, then, to the idea of a peremptory authority, such as I am supposing, that it lessens the task of personal inquiry, unless it be an objection to the authority of revelation altogether. A church, or a council, or a pope, or a consent of doctors, or a consent of Christendom, limits the inquiries of the individual in no other way than Scripture limits them. It does limit them, but while it limits their range, it preserves intact their probationary character. We are tried as really, though not on as so large, a field. To suppose that the doctrine of a permanent authority in matters of faith interferes with our free will and responsibility is, as before, to forget that there were infallible teachers in the first age, and heretics and schismatics in the ages subsequent. There may have been at once a supreme authority from first to last, and a moral judgment from first to last. Moreover, those who maintain that Christian truth must be gained solely by personal efforts are bound to show that methods ethical and intellectual are granted to individuals sufficient for gaining it. Else the mode of probation they advocate is less, not more, perfect than that which proceeds upon external authority. On the whole, then, no argument against continuing the principle of objectiveness into the developments of revelation arises out of the conditions of our moral responsibility. Perhaps it will be urged that the analogy of nature is against our anticipating the continuance of an external authority which has once been given, because, in the words of the profound thinker who has already been cited, we are wholly ignorant what degree of new knowledge it were to be expected God would give mankind by revelation, upon supposition of his affording one, or how far, or in what way, he would interpose miraculously to qualify them to whom he should originally make the revelation for communicating the knowledge given by it, and to secure their doing it to the age in which they should live, and to secure its being transmitted to posterity. And because we are not in any sort able to judge whether it were to be expected that the revelation should have been committed to writing, or left to be handed down and consequently corrupted by verbal tradition, and at length sunk under it. But this reasoning does not apply here, as has already been observed. It contemplates only the abstract hypothesis of a revelation, not the fact of an existing revelation of a particular kind, which may, of course, in various ways modify our state of knowledge, by settling some of those very points which, before it was given, we had no way of deciding. Nor can it, as I think, be fairly denied that the argument from analogy in one point of view tells against anticipating a revelation at all. For an innovation upon the physical order of the world is, by the very force of the terms, inconsistent with its ordinary course. We cannot, then, regulate our antecedent view of the character of a revelation by a test which, applied simply, overthrows the very notion of a revelation altogether. Anyhow, analogy is in some sort violated by the fact of a revelation, and the question before us only relates to the extent of that violation. I will hazard a distinction here between the facts of revelation and its principles. The argument from analogy is more concerned with its principles than with its facts. The revealed facts are special and singular, not analogous, from the nature of the case. But it is otherwise with the revealed principles. These are common to all the works of God, and if the author of nature be the author of grace, it may be expected that, while the two systems of facts are distinct and independent, the principles displayed in them will be the same, and form a connecting link between them. In this identity of principle lies the analogy of natural and revealed religion, in Butler's sense of the word. The doctrine of the incarnation is a fact, and cannot be paralleled by anything in nature. The doctrine of mediation is a principle, and is abundantly exemplified in its provisions. Miracles are facts. Inspiration is a fact. Divine teaching once for all, and a continual teaching, are each a fact. Probation by means of intellectual difficulties is a principle both in nature and in grace, and may be carried on in the system of grace either by a standing ordinance of teaching or by one definite act of teaching, and that with an analogy equally perfect in either case to the order of nature. Nor can we succeed in arguing from the analogy of that order against a standing guardianship of revelation, without arguing also against its original bestowal. Supposing the order of nature once broken by the introduction of a revelation, the continuance of that revelation is but a question of degree, and the circumstance that a work has begun makes it more probable than not that it will proceed. We have no reason to suppose that there is so great a distinction of dispensation between ourselves and the first generation of Christians, as that they had a living, infallible guidance, and we have not. The case, then, stands thus. Revelation has introduced a new law of divine governance over and above those laws which appear in the natural course of the world. And in consequence, we are able to argue for the existence of a standing authority in matters of faith on the analogy of nature and from the fact of Christianity. Preservation is involved in the idea of creation. As the Creator rested on the seventh day from the work which he had made, yet he worketh hitherto, so he gave the creed once for all in the beginning, yet blesses its growth still, and provides for its increase. His word shall not return unto him void, but accomplish his pleasure. As creation argues continual governance, so are apostles harbingers of popes. Moreover, it must be borne in mind that as the essence of all religion is authority and obedience, so the distinction between natural religion and revealed lies in this, that the one has a subjective authority and the other an objective. Revelation consists in the manifestation of the invisible divine power, or in the substitution of the voice of a lawgiver for the voice of conscience. The supremacy of conscience is the essence of natural religion. The supremacy of apostle or pope or church or bishop is the essence of revealed. And when such external authority is taken away, the mind falls back again, of necessity, upon that inward guide which it possessed even before revelation was vouchsafed. Thus, what conscience is in the system of nature, such is the voice of Scripture, or of the Church, or of the Holy See, as we may determine it in the system of revelation. It may be objected, indeed, that conscience is not infallible. It is true, but still it is ever to be obeyed. And this is just the prerogative which controversialists assign to the See of St. Peter. It is not in all cases infallible. It may err beyond its special province, but it has in all cases a claim on our obedience. All Catholics and heretics, says Bellarmine, agree in two things. First, that it is possible for the Pope, even as Pope, and with his own assembly of counselors, or with general council, to err in particular controversies of fact, which chiefly depend on human information and testimony. Secondly, that it is possible for him to err as a private doctor, even in universal questions of right, whether of faith or of morals, and that from ignorance, as sometimes happens to other doctors. Next, all Catholics agree in two other points. Not, however, with heretics, but solely with each other. First, that the Pope with general council cannot err, either in framing decrees of faith or general precepts of morality. Secondly, that the Pope, when determining anything in a doubtful matter, whether by himself or with his own particular counsel, whether it is possible for him to err or not, is to be obeyed by all the faithful. And as obedience to conscience, even supposing conscience ill-informed, tends to the improvement of our moral nature, and ultimately of our knowledge, so obedience to our ecclesiastical superior may subserve our growth in illumination and sanctity, even though he should command what is extreme or inexpedient, or teach what is external to his legitimate province. The common sense of mankind does but support a conclusion thus forced upon us by analogical considerations. It feels that the very idea of revelation implies a present informant and guide, and that an infallible one, not a mere abstract declaration of truths unknown before to man, or a record of history, or the result of antiquarian research, but a message and a lesson speaking to this man and that. This is shown by the popular notion which has prevailed among us since the Reformation, that the Bible itself is such a guide, and which succeeded in overthrowing the supremacy of Church and Pope for the very reason that it was a rival authority, not resisting merely, but supplanting it. In proportion, then, as we find in matter of fact that the inspired volume is not adapted or intended to subserve that purpose, are we forced to revert to that living and present guide who, at the era of our rejection of her, had been so long recognized as the dispenser of Scripture, according to times and circumstances, and the arbiter of all true doctrine and holy practice to her children. We feel a need, and she alone of all things under heaven supplies it. We are told that God has spoken. Where? In a book? We have tried it, and it disappoints. It disappoints us, that most holy and blessed gift, not from fault of its own, but because it is used for a purpose for which it was not given. The Ethiopian's reply, when St. Philip asked him if he understood what he was reading, is the voice of nature. How can I, unless some man shall guide me? The Church undertakes that office. She does what none else can do, and this is the secret of her power. The human mind, it has been said, wishes to be rid of doubt in religion, and a teacher who claims infallibility is readily believed on his simple word. We see this constantly exemplified in the case of individual pretenders among ourselves. In Romanism, the Church pretends to it. She rids herself of competitors by forestalling them. And probably, in the eyes of her children, this is not the least persuasive argument for her infallibility, that she alone of all churches dares claim it, as if a secret instinct and involuntary misgivings restrained those rival communions which go so far towards effecting it. These sentences, whatever be the errors of their wording, surely express a great truth. The most obvious answer, then, to the question why we yield to the authority of the Church in the questions and developments of faith, is that some authority there must be if there is a revelation given, and other authority there is none but she. A revelation is not given if there be no authority to decide what it is that is given. In the words of St. Peter to her divine Master and Lord, to whom shall we go? Nor must it be forgotten in confirmation that Scripture expressly calls the Church the pillar and ground of the truth, and promises her, as by covenant, that the Spirit of the Lord that is upon her, and his words which he has put in her mouth, shall not depart out of her mouth, nor out of the mouth of her seed, nor out of the mouth of her seed's seed, from henceforth and forever. And if the very claim to infallible arbitration in religious disputes is of so weighty importance and interest in all ages of the world, much more is it welcome at a time like the present, when the human intellect is so busy and thought so fertile and opinion so manifold. The absolute need of a spiritual supremacy is at present the strongest of arguments in favor of the fact of its supply. Surely, either an objective revelation has not been given, or it has been provided with means for impressing its objectiveness on the world. If Christianity be a social religion, which it certainly is, and if it be based on certain ideas acknowledged as divine, or a creed, which shall here be assumed, and if these ideas have various aspects and make distinct impressions on different minds, and issue in consequence in a multiplicity of developments, true or false or mixed, as has been shown, what power will suffice to meet and to do justice to these conflicting conditions but a supreme authority ruling and reconciling individual judgments by a divine right and a recognized wisdom. In barbarous times, the will is reached through the senses. But in an age in which reason, as it is called, is the standard of truth and right, it is abundantly evident to anyone who mixes ever so little with the world that if things are left to themselves, every individual will have his own view of them and take his own course. That two or three will agree today to part company tomorrow. That scripture will be read in contrary ways. And history, according to the apologue, will have to different comers its silver shield and its golden. That philosophy, taste, prejudice, passion, party, caprice will find no common measure, unless there be some supreme power to control the mind and to compel agreement. There can be no combination on the basis of truth without an organ of truth. As cultivation brings out the colors of flowers, and domestication changes the character of animals, so does education, of necessity, develop differences of opinion. And while it is impossible to lay down first principles in which all will unite, it is utterly unreasonable to expect that this man should yield to that, or all to one. I do not say that there are no eternal truths, such as the poet proclaims, which all acknowledge in private, but that there are none sufficiently commanding to be the basis of public union and action. The only general persuasive in matters of conduct is authority. That is, when truth is in question, a judgment which we feel to be superior to our own. If Christianity is both social and dogmatic and intended for all ages, it must, humanly speaking, have an infallible expounder. Else you will secure unity of form at the loss of unity of doctrine, or unity of doctrine at the loss of unity of form. You will have to choose between a comprehension of opinions and a resolution into parties, between latitudinarian and sectarian error. You may be tolerant or intolerant of contrarieties of thought, but contrarieties you will have. By the Church of England, a hollow uniformity is preferred to an infallible chair, and by the sects of England, an interminable division. Germany and Geneva began with persecution and have ended in skepticism. The doctrine of infallibility is a less violent hypothesis than this sacrifice, either of faith or of charity. It secures the object, while it gives definiteness and force to the matter of the revelation. I have called the doctrine of infallibility a hypothesis. Let it be so considered for the sake of argument. That is, let it be considered to be a mere position supported by no direct evidence, but required by the facts of the case and reconciling them with each other. That hypothesis is indeed, in a matter of fact, maintained and acted on in the largest portion of Christendom, and from time immemorial. But let this coincidence be accounted for by the need. Moreover, it is not a naked or isolated fact, but the animating principle of a large scheme of doctrine which the need itself could not simply create. But again, let this system be merely called its development. Yet even as a hypothesis which has been held by one out of various communions, it may not be lightly put aside. Some hypothesis, this or that, all parties, all controversialists, all historians must adopt, if they would treat of Christianity at all. Giesler's textbook bears the profession of being a dry analysis of Christian history, yet on inspection it will be found to be written on a positive and definite theory, and to bend facts to meet it. an unbeliever, as Gibbon, assumes one hypothesis, and an ultramontane, as Baronius, adopts another. The school of Hurd and Newton hold, as the only true view of history, that Christianity slept for centuries upon centuries, except among those whom historians call heretics. Others speak as if the oath of supremacy, or the congé de l'arrière, could be made the measure of St. Ambrose. And they fit the 39 articles on the fervid Tertullian. The question is, which of all these theories is the simplest, the most natural, the most persuasive? Certainly, the notion of development under infallible authority is not a less grave, a less winning hypothesis than the chance and coincidence of events, or the Oriental philosophy, or the working of Antichrist, to account for the rise of Christianity and the formation of its theology. End of part 4 of chapter 2.